Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. T.C. Boyle has been called by The New York Times one of the most inventive and verbally exuberant writers of his generation. He is the best-selling author of 14 novels and 9 short story collections. His newest book is The Harder They Come, which explores anti-authoritarianism and the bloodshed that can accompany it. Boyle's novels include San Miguel, Drop City, The Road to Wellville, and World's End. It's a great honor to welcome T.C. Boyle back to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. Always good to see you.
Hi, Joe. Likewise.
Very nice to have you with us. What got you thinking about this particular subject, which it seems to me comes really, I guess, from two different places, two stories?
Yes. Well, you know me well, Joe, over the years. Here's my routine. I wake up every morning and I read 2 newspapers. I live in Santa Barbara, so the Santa Barbara paper and the LA Times, over breakfast. Then I put my head down and sob for about half an hour. Then I go to work. So I am very concerned with what happens in the world. How can you help but be? And in this case, over the last few years, I've been wondering about this phenomenon of American gun violence. And in particular, in this case, the phenomenon of the individual shooter who is antisocial, often mentally disturbed, almost always a young white male, disaffected from society, and thanks to the NRA, of course, liberally supplied with weapons, who perhaps sadly in the past might have taken his own life, but instead now they seem to be competing to see how many of us they can take with them. Why is this? So I write a novel in order to try to explore that.
Do you come to a conclusion, or does it help you at least figure out what the overriding social questions are?
Yes, but I can't tell anybody that, because right, this would destroy the novel for everyone who wants to enter in it and make up his or her own judgment. I have political solutions to everything, but we'd have to have a 6-hour show for me to deal with this. Again, what a novel can do, I think, as opposed to a straight news story, is you enter into the point of view of the characters. There are 3 characters you will become if you read this book. Probably they are sort of alien to most of the listeners, but if I've done my job well, you will sympathize with their point of view. You won't agree with it, but you'll understand at least where they're coming from.
So let me just go back to this idea of reading the paper and then sobbing and then going to work. So when you start the process, and especially when you're taking on an issue like this of gun violence, is there, and sure, you may have an idea or a solution, but does it help you figure out of why it continues to be a problem, of why we don't seem to grapple it, and you hear about one horrific incident after another, and you think, well, okay, well, this will put an end to it, and then it doesn't.
It doesn't, and it, again, I don't want to really get into politics too much, but of course, we no longer live in a representative democracy. We live in corporate America in which vested interests control both houses of Congress and every politician. It's a shame. And I don't know what we can ever do about it. And of course, the NRA is prominent in this. No matter what atrocities occur, they are going to make sure that everyone has weapons. And if some of these mentally disturbed people didn't have weapons, perhaps we wouldn't have such a horrific slaughter. But again, that's not how I begin a project. I'm simply wondering about it. And I was stimulated here by 2 news stories in particular. The first is about an elderly man who was with a group of senior citizens on a tour in Mexico. I have said it in Costa Rica for my own purposes, but their tour bus was robbed by 3 assailants. He was a former Marine. He acted instinctively, grabbed one of them in a chokehold and did not let go, wound up with his bare hands killing this guy. The others ran away. This was reported in the news here, I don't know, several years back, for which he was celebrated as a hero. In my telling, he is the father of the young man who is increasingly schizophrenic and delusional and winds up shooting two citizens and then taking to the forest where he is at large for 5 weeks. They can't catch him. He lives there. He's a mountain man. He evades the police. So these two stories came together for me and formed the basis of my exploration of this American propensity towards individual shooters and gun violence.
So it's safe to say that the three characters that you focus on in the novel are damaged. They all have their issues, if you will.
Yes, we should talk about the heroine of the book, Sarah Hovarty Jennings.
Yes.
She's 40 years old. She is a sovereign citizen. The Sovereign Citizens Movement, I'm sure many of your listeners will know, is a right-wing anarchistic movement that does not believe in governmental authority of any kind. I just paid my taxes recently. I really enjoy that. I'm sure you do too, Joe.
It's a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But of course, conveniently, the sovereign citizens do not recognize the authority of the federal government to tax them. So they don't have the worries that we have. They also dispute the government's authority to force them to wear seatbelts or helmet laws or to have license plates on their cars, etc. So she is another focus of the book. And when I realized this, it then speaks to gun violence, yes, but also anti-authoritarianism, which I think is part of the American culture. It's certainly part of me. You know, we're taught from the earliest age to be skeptical of authority, to question, to be independent. And again, in a book like this, I'm kind of wondering, where is the line between being the sovereign citizen and the extreme, being the shooter, and the line at which we agree to respect each other and negotiate and create a society?
We also meet in this novel Adam. And Adam and Sarah have a relationship. How much influence does she have on him?
It's interesting. So he's 25, she's 40. She picks him up hitchhiking. And they immediately see that they have a bond, which is they hate all authority. They hate the government. They hate police.
Right.
And it becomes a kind of love story. She genuinely loves him. He is not quite capable of that. He is, again, really spiraling into schizophrenia, like the character on which I base this, by the way, the actual shooter that I'm basing the story on. I think they do spur each other in terms of cultivating a hatred of any kind of authority imposed on them.
Because there's an age difference, that she has a bit of an influence in the sense that she, with age comes wisdom, perhaps.
Hmm. There are many gradations here. And again, Joe, as you know me, I mean, this just evolves. These novels just happen day by day, piece by piece. And all these elements fell together, I think, in a way that is satisfying to me. She is not violent. She rejects authority, but she is not violent as Adam is.
When you look at the idea of violence, of how that in Adam's mind will solve something, how does that come into the mind of a shooter?
Again, you know, I'm not a sociologist and I'm not running for office yet. I can only suppose. The video games that Adam played as a boy,
yes,
the first called first-person shooter video games, it tends to desensitize normal kids, let alone someone who is mentally unstable. I don't think he really imagines things in that way. The typical Hollywood film, the thriller or the revenge thing where, you know, the first half hour, the heroes, the bad guy comes in. The hero's exclusively good. The bad guy's exclusively bad. And the bad guy comes in and, you know, rapes all of the bunnies that the hero has and then, you know, abducts his wife and so on. And then the rest of the movie, the hero comes and blows him away and we all cheer. I mean, this is a very simplistic good and bad kind of analogy. It's thrown at the public all the time. I'm wondering if things go a bit deeper. And I'm wondering, too, if perhaps that has some kind of influence on people who are susceptible, like Adam.
The third character, of course, is Sten Stenson. Tell us about Sten and how he comes into this trio.
Sten, as we said earlier, was a Marine in Vietnam. He's very macho. He doesn't back down from anything. The title of the book is The Harder They Come, The Harder They Fall. So, right. So it's a kind of challenge. Nobody is harder than me. No, I will back down from no one. And yet, he's lived a very productive life. He has been a high school principal. He contributes to society, as most of us do. And yet, he loves his son and wants to protect him, especially when the son is now being hunted by the police, who will shoot him on sight, of course, because he has killed two people. And yet, maybe this tendency toward violence goes from father to son, because Sten will not back down. There is a confrontation with people who may or may not be narcotraficantes, Mexicans who are growing illegal drugs in the woods. And Sten, even though he doubts or is skeptical that these are the actual guys, he is willing to confront them. He can't stop himself.
I also want to ask you about John Coulter and how that story plays into this and how you wanted to weave it in.
Well, as many of your listeners will know, even though I'm a California guy now, I was born and raised in Peekskill, New York.
Right.
I went to SUNY Potsdam. And I remembered the story of John Coulter from elementary school. John Coulter was one of the original mountain men. That is, in the early 1900s. I'm sorry, 19th century, the 1800s. He was one who went west of the Mississippi in order to trap beaver. The fashion was for top hats, and top hats were made of felt from beaver fur. They'd all been beavered out east of the Mississippi. Intrepid guys went into Indian territory to get it. Well, of course, the Indians weren't that happy about this. And Coulter was captured one day by the Blackfeet. And they were debating how best to torture him to death. I mean, should we peel his skin off and make him eat it and laugh at the same time, set his hair on fire? What are we going to do? And this particular day, they decided they would have a kind of human fox hunt. Coulter is naked with no shoes on, and they give him a 100-yard start, and then the swiftest young braves with their spears are going to chase him down and spear him. Well, of course, he had great incentive, and he was able to escape, famously, Coulter's Run. And I realized that this man is Adam's hero. Adam wants to be like Coulter, even identifies himself. People say, "What's your name?" He says, "I'm Coulter." And again, this speaks to a lot of the themes you know from my previous books. I'm interested in our relationship to nature, our relationship to this planet as another animal species on the planet. And so Adam wants to live in nature and make his living from nature. He's growing opium poppies with the deluded idea that he will make opium and sell it to people. He doesn't really think this through, but he wants to live off the land as all pioneers did, as Coulter did. I'm just wondering, can this happen in our society? Ironically, of course, with Adam, it can't, not only because he's delusional, but because, like all of us, he's attached to society. He needs his freeze-dried Swedish meals, to eat in the woods. He needs Sarah to wash his clothes for him, to get him medicine when he gets Giardia. So there are many levels of irony in the book, which I think help deepen what this is about, these themes that we're talking about.
How much research do you want to do? How much fact do you want about mental illness, about gun violence, of numbers? How much does that interest you of having those firm facts at your fingertips while you are creating this fictional story?
I like to have the facts, Joe. And I like to present them to you because they fascinate me. So with my historical novels, for instance, the history is straight. There's no rules. This is fiction.
Right.
But I love to have those facts. That said, I'm not coming from a journalistic background. I didn't really care about that. So when I went to Fort Bragg, California, where this happens, I spent a couple of weeks there and poked around. I went in the woods. I saw the sights that I needed to see. Spoke to people, but not about what I'm doing. I just wanted a sense of the place. I don't go and interview the police chief. I don't know the actual people mentioned in this police report. I just read the police report, see the place, and create something for my own purposes. So yes, I like to be well informed, but that doesn't necessarily play into this. This is a fiction for me is a kind of dream. It's an opening up of the unconscious to create a work of art that, in many cases, with me at any rate, has to do with some social issue. Listeners will know the Tortilla Curtain from 1995 about illegal immigration in Southern California. I'm not pushing a point of view. I'm opening up the subject to debate.
And I always think about this, but there's something about this book is deeply unsettling, but yet entertaining. How does one pull that off?
I don't know. It's just pure magic. I just do what I'm going to do. It's part of being an artist and making a work of art. My best friend in L.A., Pablo Campos, is an artist. He's painting all the time, and he goes through many different phases. He's obsessed with it. This is all he does. I likewise am obsessed with making fiction. I don't want to write essays. I don't want to be a journalist. I just want to do this because it fascinates me. I don't know what it's going to be. And when I see its shape and its form, it seems beautiful to me. And it's incredibly rewarding to do it.
Do you always see the shape and the form in the sense that you always know that balance will remain, that yes, you'll get the message and what you want to say will be clear, there will still be an unsettling aspect, and yet it still will be entertaining. Are you concerned about that balance? Does that come naturally, or do you have to think about that?
It comes naturally, absolutely. Art, no matter how complex or beautiful or how much we want to talk about it, is entertainment. If it's not entertaining, it doesn't exist.
Right.
You know, and that could be said of any painting, any piece of music. Oh, of course, we may have different opinions about it, but it begins as entertainment.
Does that at all then dictate the subject? Is there any subject that wouldn't be...
No. I don't choose a subject because it might sell books. I don't concern myself with that. Once I publish a book, of course, I'm out here on a tour for my publisher and so on. But I don't really care about that. I only care about what I'm interested in. And then, of course, I want to make you interested in it, too, because it fascinates me.
So you don't think, oh, this is a subject, maybe not even commercially, but something, a subject that you yourself do not want to be with for a while?
I take it as a challenge to be able to write on any subject from any point of view in any mode. So that, for instance, the novel before this, San Miguel, which was the hardest one I had to do, is set on an island off the California coast. It's an historical piece. I'm working from a fragmentary diary and a memoir, entirely from the point of view of women who lived on this island, and non-ironic, because the tone of this was non-ironic. Could I do that? Could I, without a hint of irony, do a naturalistic novel? I set it as a challenge, and I was satisfied with the result, although it's not my natural mode. I think, you know, you don't want to repeat yourself. You want to push at the limits.
Do you know what is interesting of what is to you that artistic challenge that you want to set? Do you think of that as a long range plan? Someday I would like to tackle this type of novel or to do this type of work.
To a degree, Joe, yes. But basically, the material dictates what it's going to be and what mode it's going to be in. So I don't really say I'd like to write, a novel in the style of Ulysses, you know? I don't say that to myself. I just find what I want to write about, and the voice comes, and the voice is always different. The book I'm halfway through now, that I'm working on now, The Terranauts, has three narrators, two females, one male, and they're I narrators. So it's point of view, like in The Harder They Come, but that's a third-person point of view, which is more normal. These are three I narrators talking to you, telling the same story, essentially. But, of course, they have a different take on each incident. I'd never done that before, and I'm exploring it to see what will come of it.
What does rewriting and going back, how does that process work for you?
I'm a fanatic of detail. I rewrite constantly. I can't move forward unless I feel everything behind me is really solid. And I never write out of sequence. It just develops. And it's magical. It's it's organic. It just has to happen. It's a discovery. Each day, each line, you make a discovery. But that said, I am constantly rewriting. I love the way it looks on the page. I love to. I read out loud to my wife every day to hear the rhythm. I always listen to music while working. All the elements have to be just right for me to be satisfied with it.
For some reason, I'm fascinated by this question of asking writers if they listen to music. Some will tell you that they have to have just incredible silence. And there's others that say that they would not be able to work if they did not have music. And then often they will then show me their playlist. Their playlist of what actually went through when they were creating that particular work. What is it that has to be? Is there a void that needs to be filled for you? Is it inspirational? Is it something that you draw from in some unconscious way?
All the above. Exactly.
Yeah.
Perfectly said, Joe. That's what it is. I couldn't imagine working without music playing. Language is rhythmic. It has to be. I mean, poor writing, and we all know that there is a lot of poor writing out there, is flat. It doesn't scan. It doesn't have a beat. It's so important to me, which, by the way, is another reason why I love to go out and perform for the public. And I don't call it a reading. I call it a performance purposely because I want to turn people on to the entertainment value of stories. Why do we love stories? I hear my mother's voice in my head. She taught me how to read. I hear Donald Grant, my eighth grade English teacher, who was an amateur actor, reading us To Build a Fire, you know, and The Monkey's Paw and The Most Dangerous Game. I mean, I walk out of his classroom trembling. And I want to give that back to the public.
When the music that you listened to for writing The Harder They Come, is that similar to the music that you listened to for San Miguel?
Probably the same music. And, okay, of course, we do have Jimmy Cliff sneaking in here. The Harder They Come,
yes,
was his reggae song. And I do reference that, of course. But it's more of the phrase, the harder they come, the harder they fall, as I said earlier. You'd think that when I'm writing a period piece, I would listen to music of that period. Because I'm basically listening to classical music and the jazz of my youth, John Coltrane, Miles Davis, etc. That doesn't work that way. It's just, what do I feel like hearing right now? Sorry to say it, Joe, but lately I feel like playing Mozart's Requiem over and over all day long, every day. And I do.
Jazz influences many writers.
I don't know. I don't know what the other writers do. I mean, we don't really discuss shop so much. Everybody finds his own way. You know what's so interesting of all these shows that I do around the country all the time? The audience questions, which I love, are often about process. How do you do this? How do you do that?
Right.
And it's interesting, of course, and I love to talk about it, but really, it doesn't have any relevance to the next writer. Everyone finds his or her own way of accommodating their own art and their own artistic impulse in their own way.
So how do you, as a teacher, help that writer cultivate that in their own way?
I'm their coach. I am their coach. I don't want to impose anything on them aesthetically other than to let them know if I find this is working and why, and in an interpretive way, and if it's beautiful. But I wouldn't want to impose anything on them. I think the worst teachers are ones who can't see beyond their own aesthetic. I want each to develop in his or her own way as an individual artist. So, of course, I will suggest things for them to read. Oh, wow, you've written a story about the two-headed dog? Well, have you read Julio Cortázar? You know, that kind of thing. If you don't have a great gift for an art, you're not going to be a great artist. That said, though, to take creative writing in college is like taking a course in French or learning how to paint or learning an instrument. It's a way of discovering an art from the inside. Obviously, many of my students have gone on to careers as writers. Others, you know, they're basically sitting on the boulevard begging for change, but with very creative signs.
And in both cases, you're proud.
I am. Yes. I am.
T.C. Boyle's new novel is The Harder They Come, and is published by Echo. It's always great to have you here. Thank you very much for talking about what you do.
My pleasure, Joe.
Great.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us, book@wamc.org. You can also listen to this again or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.